This is Donald Trump conspiring to commit an armed robbery, to steal the votes of the people in those states, to steal the election from them, to steal the election in each of these states.
Thank you, Joy Reid. Was that so difficult? Doesn't hurt that she follows me on Twitter, I guess.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I'll take what I can get.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. As a matter of fact, it's a special edition of the broadcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Quote, "It has to be made clear that trying to violently overthrow the government, trying to stop the peaceful transition of power, and assaulting law enforcement officers in that effort is going to be met with absolutely certain punishment." That quote was not from Special Counsel Jack Smith announcing Donald Trump's latest indictment on four federal felony counts, including conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of and attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against civil rights in attempting to steal the right to vote of millions of Americans in his attempt to steal the 2020 presidential election. In fact, that quote was from U.S. District Court judge in D.C., Tanya Chutkan, who was randomly drawn to oversee the former president's new indictment. Judge Chutkan is known for tough sentences for January 6 defendants. In fact, she is the only judge who has reportedly issued harsher sentences in some cases than those sought by prosecutors. Good. So she has already made some decisions that almost have certainly infuriated the newest D.C. January 6 defendant. The Obama-appointed jurist ruled in the fall of 2021 that the bipartisan U.S. House Select Committee investigating January 6 could, in fact, access reams of Donald Trump White House files as part of their probe. Her ruling was subsequently upheld by an appeals court and by the Trump-packed U.S. Supreme Court. She made clear at the time her horror over the attack at the U.S. Capitol, lamenting back then over the prospect of renewed political violence in 2024 and noting that no one accused of orchestrating the effort to subvert the election had been held accountable, at least not at that point. The evidence she allowed access to by the House committee 2 years ago, that would be call logs, memos, internal strategy papers, emails, and more from the desks of Trump's most trusted advisors, became the backbone of the committee's evidence, which ultimately shaped much of both the public understanding of Trump's multiple failed efforts to steal the 2020 presidential election and the ensuing federal indictment for it handed up by a D.C. grand jury to the judge on Tuesday as sought by Special Counsel Jack Smith. In her ruling 2 years ago, allowing Congress to review those records from the former president's White House, Judge Chutkan, in her opinion, almost certainly stung Trump at the time when she wrote, quote, "Presidents are not kings and plaintiff is not president." Jack Smith would appear to agree, noting in the first paragraph of his 45-page indictment, in case anybody still had any question about it, that, quote, "The defendant, Donald J. Trump, lost the 2020 presidential election. Despite having lost," the indictment explains, "the defendant was determined to remain in power. So, for more than 2 months following Election Day on November 3, 2020, the defendant spread lies that there had been outcome determinative fraud in the election and that he had actually won. He was, according to the indictment, aided in his desperate, pathetic, knowing, and wildly dangerous scheme by at least six still uncharged co-conspirators described but not named in the indictment, but known to include rogue Trump attorneys Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, Kenneth Cheesebro, the dude who appears to have come up with the fake elector strategy to try and steal the election on January 6th. Also described but not named is then rogue DOJ Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Clark and a still unidentified political consultant described by Jack Smith as having helped implement the plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceedings. Key to Jack Smith's charges is that Trump knew he was lying about fraud in the 2020 election, after he had been informed by his own top advisors and appointees in his own campaign, in his White House, at his Department of Justice, at other federal agencies, and by top state and local officials, dozens and dozens and dozens of times, many of which are detailed in the indictment, that he was told that there was no such fraud that could have changed the outcome of the 2020 results for him in any of the states that he was claiming, ironically enough, were stolen from him. Just a couple very quick examples among scores in the indictment. Paragraph 25 on page 13. On December 8, 2020, a senior campaign advisor who spoke with the defendant, that would be Trump, on a daily basis and had informed him on multiple occasions that various fraud claims were untrue, expressed frustration that many of co-conspirator one, that would be Giuliani, and his legal team's claims could not be substantiated. As early as mid-November, for instance, the senior campaign advisor had informed the defendant, Trump, that his claims of a large number of dead voters in Georgia were untrue. On December 8, the senior campaign advisor wrote in an email, quote, "When our research and campaign legal team can't back up any of the claims made by our elite strike force legal team, you can see why we're 0-13 on our cases. I'll obviously hustle to help on all fronts," he said, "but it's tough to own any of this when it's all just conspiracy bleep beamed down from the mothership." One other example, paragraph 28, page 14. On December 23, 2020, a day after the defendant's chief of staff, that would be Mark Meadows, personally observed the signature verification process at the Cobb County Civic Center in Georgia and notified defendant Trump that state election officials were, quote, "conducting themselves in an exemplary fashion," unquote, and would find fraud if it existed, the defendant then went out and tweeted that the Georgia officials administering the signature verification process were trying to hide evidence of election fraud and were, quote, "terrible people." Well, someone's a terrible person here, but it wasn't those folks in Georgia trying to do a post-election signature audit heroically in the middle of a deadly pandemic. All of Trump's claims of fraud and having won the 2020 election, writes Smith, quote, "were false, and the defendant, Trump, knew that they were false. But the defendant repeated and widely disseminated them anyway to make his knowingly false claims appear legitimate, create an intense national atmosphere of mistrust and anger, and erode public faith in the administration of the election." Defendant Donald J. Trump may now finally be held to account for his knowing lies and his blatant and happily failed attempts as president of the United States to try and steal the 2020 presidential election. But we will see. Trump will be arraigned for these crimes before Judge Chutkan at the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C. on Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And that is the news which broke just minutes before airtime on our previous broadcast, sending the delightful Desi Doyen and me scrambling to toss out our previous planned hour and cover the breaking news with a semblance of cogency. Is that a word, Desi Doyen?
We tried. All I can say is we tried.
Yeah, we did try. Happily today, we'll have a bit of help. But hello, Desi. And I take it you're a little bit less frazzled than
yesterday. Yes, much better today.
That's only because Fani has not come in with her indictments yet before airtime. Anyway, second, I'm happy to be joined today by two favorite guests of ours to hopefully offer some well-reasoned insight and perspective 24 hours or so later. How easy for them. As noted at the end of yesterday's program, we would indeed be sending up the Digby signal, and happily she answered it after having joined us on this program for just about every major moment in the nightmarish Trump presidency. From the day he came down the escalator through his reign of terror on the Constitution and the public and indeed the world, up through what is now officially his third personal felony indictment in about 4 months. Heather Digby Parton is the proprietor of the long-running Hullabaloo blog and a regular award-winning columnist at Salon.com. Oh, Heather, thank you for answering the call.
I am so happy to be here today. I can't tell you.
It is great to have you here. I can't tell you. Also answering the call on short notice is our old friend Driftglass, also known as Mr. Electrico on the social media site formerly known as Twitter and even occasionally known as just Bill, at least to his wife, with whom he has long hosted the Professional Left podcast, recorded every Friday, rain or shine, as they say, from what they lovingly describe as flyover country, Illinois. Oh, Driftglass, Mr. Electrico, or Bill, welcome back to the broadcast, amigo.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here on this day.
Nobody believes you, but it is a pleasure, actually. As I say, three out of what are expected to be four indictments, I think, before this month is over. I know that this is the one, however, that many have been waiting for. In truth, I'm still more interested in what comes out from Fani Willis in Fulton County, Georgia. But let's start with Digby here. While we've known this was coming, we've known this day was coming for a long time, were there any surprises for you in Jack Smith's 45-page charging document unsealed on Tuesday?
Well, I think what surprised me most was that he ended up just indicting Donald Trump and had these other six as the co-conspirators, unindicted co-conspirators. And apparently there's a reason for that. They think that maybe this will get, you know, it will cause fewer delays to just have Donald Trump be the sole subject of the indictment, and they are theoretically going to possibly indict some of these others unless somebody else tries to flip. And I will just say, as we're waiting for Fani Willis to perhaps drop her case today, I did read on Twitter a passing note that they thought maybe some of these co-conspirator indictments might be coming down today. So just so you know, I don't know if that's true, but I just saw it in passing.
Okay. Well, as long as it doesn't come in over the next hour or so, we'll be fine, I'm sure. Driftglass, your first impressions and or anything that struck or surprised you about Trump's now third indictment?
Well, it did come down moments before we were going to record our other podcast, our No Fair Remembering Stuff podcast.
Aha, so okay.
We did a little dance and incorporated it into that one. Same as Digby, the fact that the other people were stripped out and not indicted on this to sort of streamline it, that's my understanding, so it'll get to court as fast as possible. And honestly, the quality of the writing was really good. I mean, you know, I would kill if Hollywood could produce screenplays that are this clear and coherent, it tells a good story, and it moves along swiftly to a conclusion. And it's just, as a writer, I'm like deeply impressed with the amount of work that went into creating this thing as a machine. It's really, really efficient.
It is quite readable, whether it will be read by the bulk of the American people, whether it will be read by Republicans at this point is unclear. Either of you guys have any idea who co-conspirator six is? He's the or she is the only one so far unnamed, and it's unclear who it is. So do you have any idea who that is? And do you have any idea why Republican RNC chair Ronna Romney McDaniel, why is she not cited as a co-conspirator? It seems like she was coordinating the whole fake electors scheme. Driftglass?
I think there's such a long list to choose from. You could take a bucket of all the possible co-conspirators and toss a dart into it and come up with someone who's plausible. Mm-hmm. I've heard Jason Miller floated. Mm-hmm. I've heard Ginny Thomas floated. There are, but it is like playing a little bit like playing Columbo. There are a few facts in the document that happy that all of them don't know who it is, and they're all, I hope, sweating today, wondering, is it me? Is it me? Because it could be me. And urging them to flip.
I think just because they're not named in this particular indictment, is there any reason to believe that Jack Smith, in addition to bringing indictments for these listed co-conspirators, couldn't also bring additional charges for some of these other people, Heather?
Absolutely not. And we've seen that in the Mar-a-Lago case, where they came through and they just did a superseding indictment for Trump and for this other, co-conspirator of his down there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a good chance, and most of the lawyers seem to think that there's just no way that they're not going to charge these five, attorneys who were, quote, advising Trump to overthrow the government. As for the sixth, I do have an idea.
Uh-huh.
I read somewhere that people are thinking it's Boris Epstein, which is kind of interesting because he's a lawyer, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an email that's cited specifically in there that was sent from him to Giuliani, or to this co-conspirator number six, to Giuliani on a specific date. And I think that some of the reporters have tracked that to Epstein. So, he was a lawyer. He's a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and he's sort of acting as a quasi, what are they calling it, in-house counsel
mm-hmm.
now. But at the time, I think that he was serving as a political advisor, some kind of a campaign advisor. So that's a guess. I mean, obviously, I have no idea, but that's just something that I read. So there you have it.
I have also seen some reporting from attorneys that say, hey, it's also possible that these people, the co-conspirators, have already been indicted, but those might have been sealed.
Yep. Yep.
And we just don't know yet. So I think you're probably right, Digby, that there's no way it seems that they cannot indict these co-conspirators.
I think the biggest surprise actually for me, and there was a lot in here, John Eastman being involved much more than I thought, actually calling state legislators and saying, hey, let the court sort it out. Just go ahead and decertify based on fraud, even though we don't know what any, we haven't identified any, but just go ahead and do it. That surprised me. But the biggest surprise, I think, is that it took this long to get here. And, as we've been discussing, I think Jack Smith likely has much, much more, and there's going to be more indictments and perhaps even more charges for Donald Trump down the road. But the bulk of what is contained in the indictment, Heather, was stuff that was already found at least a year ago by the House January 6th committee that I was probably talking to you and Driftglass about almost a year ago now.
That's right. And I think there are a couple of things about that that I think are really interesting. The first is that, it appears that the Department of Justice really didn't do much in the first year. For whatever reason, they were laying out, we don't really know what the thinking was there. Maybe they were, working on getting evidence from people's phones and it was taking forever. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about why the delay in doing that. But of course, Jack Smith, when they turned it over to Jack Smith, it seemed like, they were sort of ready to go.
Mm.
And he has not taken that long. I think he was appointed in, what was it, last November?
November, late November.
Yeah, November.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's moved pretty quickly on this when you consider the scope of the case. But a lot of those of us who followed the January 6th committee hearings and the report that they put out at the end, this follows that narrative, and it follows it really pretty closely. There is some new information in it.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Mike Pence cooperated and gave testimony that sheds light on some of the stuff that Trump was saying to him personally, which is, trying to coerce him into, committing a felony. So we know that the January 6th committee, it appears, the work that they did probably flowed pretty directly into the DOJ case when Jack Smith came in. He had all that stuff. At least it gave it some kind of an outline for,
mm-hmm.
for the kind of thing that they could look for. And the second thing I wanted to say about that is that the hearings that we saw, I mean, we covered them. I think I was on with you after every single one.
Yeah.
We're not going to get a televised trial. I know a lot of people are hoping that they will, but it's up to John Roberts. And come on, let's be serious.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that he's going to go along with that. So what we are going to get, we'll get breathless reports from the reporters. And, you know, it'll be exciting and interesting and historical and, you know, historic. It'll be all the good things. But the fact that we had those televised hearings with those witnesses and we heard them say this is really going to play into the national consciousness of how this trial is going to play out. So, you know, we may not see Trump sitting there, which is unfortunate. I would really like to see that. But I think that this trial, the outcome, hopefully the outcome that we all believe that it should have, will have credibility largely because we did get to see all of that already in the January 6th committee. So, I mean, it's better than nothing, right?
Well, I guess so. I wonder if, you know, some of the charges, one of the things that many of us believed was going on at the Department of Justice, and I think it was going on, was they were obviously, you know, rounding up about 1,000 of the folks on the ground. They were working their way up through the Oath Keepers and the 3% centers and so forth, and bringing conspiracy charges against them. And we sort of thought, okay, what they're going to do is eventually tie it up through, Roger Stone and Steve Bannon and so forth up to the White House. That's the connection that was not made here. I don't know if it ever will be. But, you know, without that stuff, you sort of almost, I mean, how is it that a House committee, Driftglass, can get this information a year before the Department of Justice with all of the resources that the Department of Justice has at its fingertips?
Yeah, I too got the impression they were going after. I think today, the 1,096th or 7th January 6th insurrectionist is going to trial or being sentenced. So the thing that impressed me was, because the January 6th committee is misnamed, it is not the January 6th committee, because it's this huge conspiracy that peaked on January 6th.
Yep.
Right.
But it was understanding the sort of the sweep of what was going on, how extensive the conspiracy was, how deep it went, where all the roots went, and the fact that there were all these different paths that all these different people were trying to accomplish the same ends until they finally just said, screw it, we're going in, and that's the last thing we can do. I think they didn't understand how big this thing was until they got into it.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to realize, holy crap, this is vast. This makes Watergate look like a third-rate burglary.
Yep.
This is really serious, and it involves lots of different branches of government. It involves people outside the government. It could have potentially involved the military, and on and on and on. And so they sort of had a hard time getting their arms around exactly how big this was, and where do you start when you're starting with just the mob that tried to break in and sort of work your way backwards. So I know it was a big piece of work. I'm deeply impressed by the work they did.
Mm-hmm.
I wish this had all happened 8 months ago, 9 months ago, a year ago. I wish they had a bigger bulldozer to dig out with, but they were fighting against the obstruction of everyone involved, including pretty much the entire Republican Party. So,
I've referred to, and you're right, I think it was misnamed. It was already a long name, but that said, I've sort of always referred to it as the House January 6th, or the House Committee investigating January 6th and Trump's other failed attempts to steal the election.
Exactly.
Because there were a lot of them, and a lot of them are detailed in this indictment. They tried, in fact, everything they could to could think of, and they were pretty inventive to steal the 2020 election. But even the Jack Smith indictment does not use that word,
right,
even though it's the easiest and simplest explanation for what they were doing. Do you, Bill Driftglass, have any idea what the allergy is to asserting the plain fact that a sitting American president has attempted over and over again to steal a presidential election? The only use of that word in the entire indictment, I think, is a quote from Trump where he says something like, "This is what happens when you steal an election from the American people," falsely claiming that Democrats had stolen the election. My argument here is that it would be a hell of a lot easier for the American people to understand what just happened if they described it in those simplest terms possible. What is the allergy to Democrats, to Jack Smith even, and to the media from using that word?
Well, I'm a Democrat, and I will say, for the record, he tried to steal the election.
Okay,
so
good.
you got one on your
All
side.
All right, one so far. And I should note, by the way, Joy Reid on MSNBC has been using that description. She used it a lot yesterday. As it turns out, ironically enough, I believe she's the only one on MSNBC that has been following the Brad blog on Twitter for years and years. Anyway, yeah, please proceed, Governor.
I'm trying to separate myself as a Democrat from the fact that these are a bunch of lawyers who are bringing a case, indictment before a court. And they want to be extremely careful about the language they use.
Yes.
And they want to be extremely careful about laying into the text anything that the defense can exploit. And that going after it sort of just as a series of three or four understandable, comprehensible, legally adjudicable crimes is just easier than trying to throw a whole thing over it that says this was a vast insurrection conspiracy to overthrow the government, which it was, clearly was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just easier. I mean, you know, they got Capone for tax evasion.
Right. I accept that from the prosecutors, and because there is no, you know, crime called election theft at the federal level, to my knowledge. I accept it from them. But what's up with the elected Democratic officials? What's up with most notably the media here? Because, I mean, is there any question that if the situation was reversed, that is exactly how Republicans would be characterizing what happened, and therefore the media would be characterizing it that way, and therefore the American people would see it that way?
Well, now this only goes for an hour, right, the show?
We'll see.
Put a nickel in me, I'll talk for
All
3 days
right, go
about
ahead.
The Democrats
right,
and the
yeah.
media. But
we'll
yeah,
see.
I completely agree. And I really do wish that there was a concatenation of events that goes from X to the media to the American people. I don't think there is any such thing as the American people anymore.
Mm.
I think there are people in the middle who are desperate to stay in the middle. There are a bunch of Democrats and liberals and lefties and people like you and I who pretty much understand what's going on here. And then there are the unreachable, uneducable right. And it really doesn't matter what the facts are, what the New York Times says, what I say. They're never going to be reached. So I think right now, politically, we are in the middle of trench warfare. We're going, you know, we're playing for inches right now because there's never going to be a hole blown in the GOP so big that you're going to get landslides like Johnson or Roosevelt.
Let me, we're going to take a break here shortly and come back and talk more about the politics. But Heather, I think I've spoken to you about this before. But do you want to ring in on this? Since you know you put a nickel in Drift Glass, and boy, he'll talk for an hour. And so,
I will ring in on it and defend myself. May I just read to you the?
Yes.
The kicker of my piece that I wrote for Salon this morning.
Yes, please.
Donald Trump is under indictment for trying to steal an election, but he may very well be given absolution for his crimes by the free and fair electoral system he has demeaned and degraded ever since he entered politics.
There you go.
You know, I do
Thank you.
Read the Brad blog
Thank
every
you.
Day.
Thank you.
That is, and I can prove it.
Thank you.
By the
well,
fact that I said that.
Yes. I guess I'm winning him over one reader or listener at a time. That's all I can do. Thank you. This case, before we get to a break, we mentioned the other two indictments. There's a fourth one coming, but something about this case seems different than the other ones. The other ones, they are about corruption and accountability, as is this case. Obviously, you know, stealing, there's that word again, stealing classified national security documents from the White House is a huge deal. But there's something about this one, it feels like to me, because because it's also about democracy and the heart of how this country works and why it really does matter to the rest of the world. Heather, do you have that sense on this particular case, the sort of
Absolutely.
Gravity here on this?
Absolutely. They're all big, right? I mean, the fact that a former president, and, you know, there are many cases that could have been brought against him. He was corrupt the entire time he was in office, running his business out of the Oval Office. He had a pay-to-play hotel right down the street where people were dumping huge, vast sums of money into his pocket while he was president. I mean, there's a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
And all of these cases, the E. Jean Carroll to the, you know, Alvin Bragg case in Manhattan, the Letitia James civil case up there, Mar-a-Lago, Fonnie Willis. This, it goes directly to the heart of the worst thing he did. And he did a lot of horrible things. But this is historic. We've never seen anything like it. In fact, Neil Katyal was on MSNBC yesterday. And, I mean, he was the former acting former acting Solicitor General under Obama. And he is, you know, he's all over TV. And he's a, you know, kind of a big Supreme Court, you know, litigator. In any case, what he said yesterday, I mean, he said that this is one of the most significant legal events ever in the history of this country. It's up there with Marbury versus Madison, Brown versus Board of Education, and Dred Scott as a defining case for the Times. He said this case lays out, this indictment lays out a case that a guy who was president of the United States while he was president of the U.S. leveraged his office, used his power to thwart the will of the people in the most solemn thing they do in our country, vote. This is the biggest constitutional crime in our history. I mean, you know, I'll endorse that. I mean, it's huge. It is really, really a big deal.
The biggest constitutional crime in our history. Agree, Driftglass?
Amen. Other than seceding from the Union and making actual war on the United States government, yeah, this is the biggest constitutional crime against the Constitution, crime against the fundamental institution of our country ever.
Well, give it time. The summer is barely underway. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with our special coverage of Donald Trump's third indictment and arguably his biggest one with Heather Digby Parton of Salon and Driftglass of the Pro Left Podcast and, of course, Desi Doyen and me, Brad Friedman, right here on the Bradcast. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you can rest easy knowing that we'll be here every day making sense of it all, or at least trying to. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thanks.
Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Good advice. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Special coverage of Donald Trump's latest indictment. In case you're hearing this some weeks down the road in reruns, this would be his third of fourth, probably, indictment. His second federal indictment, with Georgia still to come. Bet on it. All right, let me, we've got Heather Digby Parton of Salon, Driftglass of Pro Left Podcast here. Let me give you guys a chance. I want to hit some of the politics here. A chance to respond to some of the responses from Donald Trump on his social media site. He will be in, arraigned on Thursday. I'm guessing he's going to plead not guilty, but, you know, and of course he is not guilty until he's been proven guilty. But let me hit a couple of his comments from his social media site. Heather, you can take this one. Quote, why didn't they bring this ridiculous case 2.5 years ago? They wanted it right in the middle of my campaign. That's why. Heather?
Well, it's ridiculous, obviously, and we just talked about why it was delayed, but clearly, I mean, this is a big case. The cases take time, and it's not surprising that it would have taken 2.5 years for them to get to, from January 6th to an indictment. As far as doing it in the middle of his campaign, he's the one, of course, projecting again. He's the one who announced his campaign, you know, practically right out of, you know, the day he left office, in order for him to make this argument. Well, you can't do this. I mean, everything he's doing right now, his entire campaign, his quest for getting back into the office, and his hope that he can become president again, is to keep his sorry behind out of jail. That's where he's at right now. And so this is just another of his, you know, projections onto the Justice Department. They didn't care about, you know, to the extent that they care about him running, it's that they're trying to get it before it gets to the point where it's too close to the election. So he's out of his mind.
And actually, to be more specific, the only reason that Jack Smith is on this case is because right after the 2022 elections, that's when he officially declared that he was a candidate, and when Merrick Garland named Jack Smith. Had he not, Merrick Garland might have still been considering the matter, and we wouldn't have these indictments. So, again, he has only himself to blame. All right, Driftglass, this from his statement. He put out a 4 or 5 paragraph statement in response to the indictment concerning his efforts to steal the 2020 election. Quote, "The lawlessness of these persecutions of President Trump and his supporters is reminiscent of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, the former Soviet Union, and other authoritarian dictatorial regimes. President Trump has always followed the law and the Constitution with advice from many highly accomplished attorneys."
Yeah, the founding fathers came up to him with tears in their eyes, going, "Sir, sir, sir." Yeah, but I've heard it said that, you know, martyring yourself is hard because getting that last nail in is really, really impossible. You know, this is just Trump stuff. This is just worse than the Nazis, worse than the Cardassians on Star Trek, worse than Darth Vader. And, it you know, it's gibberish. It is meaningless, but it is intentional because it keeps the people that he wants on his side on his side. And he is absolutely shameless, and we've known this since the day he came down the escalator. Whatever red meat I need to throw to the meatheads to keep them angry and charged up and sending me money, I'll do. And he is cranking out, you know, content bits for Byron York, you know, all the smart intellectuals, you know, the National Review crowd are all like, this is the worst thing that ever happened. This is the most unfair thing in the world. He's cranking out content for Fox and for Newsmax and all the megaphones that he needs to keep himself afloat and raising money. So, you know, this is just going to go on forever. It's now routine. It shouldn't be. Screaming Nazi and they're out to get me should not be routine for a president, former president, to get away with. But that's who he is.
Well,
so no surprise.
As they say about the Republicans, Donald Trump these days, every accusation is a confession. Heather, Rudy Giuliani, his aide, apparently he has an aide still, a guy by the name of Ted Goodman, put out a statement that, quote, "Every fact the former New York City mayor establishes the good faith basis President Donald Trump had for the actions he took during the 2-month period charged in the indictment." So I guess they are claiming that all of these false claims about fraud, proven to be false over and over again, are actually still true. According to Rudy Giuliani's spokesperson, to quote from the now quaint Watergate era, "Does that dog still hunt?"
Oh, absolutely not. But I'm sure that they're going to try and do that. I mean, from what I gathered in the first few hours, you know, they went crazy on Fox News and Newsmax and OAN and all the rest of them. That, you know, that is going to be part of the defense, at least publicly. I don't know if the lawyers will try and want to, you know, open up that can of worms in there. I kind of doubt it, but you never know. I mean, these aren't just look. I mean, he's had 5 lawyers named as co-conspirators,
yes.
And maybe the 6th one's a lawyer too. So let's just say the caliber of his legal advice isn't the greatest, because he's indicted because of the stuff that they were helping him do. And you know, I don't think that you know, that's necessarily going to be a good excuse, but you're going to hear it, no doubt about it, that of course it was true, that, you know, all those claims that Donald Trump made, and Trump's going to make them do that because that is exactly what he wants to hear. I mean, they are, you know, they're persecuting him because he won the election and tried to, you know, save democracy by doing all these things and was thwarted, and here he comes again. He's going to save us now. We're going to get him back into the White House. I mean, that's going to be the argument for him. And it's, you know, it's pathetic, and it gives you a big headache, and, you know, you want to throw something, but that's where we're at.
Well, I also think that part of what seems to be suggested by Republicans on Fox News and other right-wing media, and also from at least one of the Trump lawyers, they seem to be suggesting that they're going to argue that because Trump really believed what some of his lawyers told him, that therefore his efforts were all in good faith and they can't get him on what he actually believed was true. But something that Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, had said was, she's like, you know, whether he believed it or not, despite it being very clear that he was explicitly told over and over and over again that he was absolutely wrong, regardless of whether he believed it, it doesn't actually matter, Marcy says, because one of the counts that he is under, the obstructing the counting of the Electoral College vote, that conspiracy, she says that even if Trump believed he won, he can't conspire to stop the counting of the Electoral College vote. Regardless of what you believe, you're not allowed to do that.
Bill Driftglass, Mr. Electrico, what will history have to say about Mike Pence? I believe, and I know Digby has disagreed with me about this in the past, but I actually believe that Pence was, in fact, yes, an actual profile in courage on January 6th and in the lead up to January 6th. And I know that's outrageous to think of Mike Pence and courage in the same sentence, but I actually think that he was. Nonetheless, since then, it seems like he has done everything possible to reverse that legacy since January 6th for some reason. How does this fall for history down the road?
Well, someone once told me that appeals to history are a secular plea for divine judgment, and it is the idea that what will people in the future, looking back on this, say? And you know, we can't possibly know. I would suggest that Mike Pence tried everything in his power to comply with his boss. He called Dan Quayle because, you know, whenever I'm in doubt about some moral question on which the future of the nation hangs, I call Dan Quayle and ask him. Didn't call Dick Cheney. Didn't call anybody else. Called Dan Quayle. And he really, really wanted someone to tell him it was okay. And it wasn't okay. And he got in a place where he could either go down in history as the man who blew up the country, or he could do one right thing when people were storming the Capitol, threatening to murder him. And he did the right thing at the right time, and has lived to regret it, because he's a Republican. And in the Republican Party, he is a Judas. He is a traitor. He has turned on them, and there is a separate branch of history that apparently Republicans read, where Nixon was screwed, and he should have burned the tapes, and Mike Pence will go down in that book as Judas and the traitor, or he'll disappear from history completely. He is a fraction of a man. And he did one right thing on the day, and that's great. I'm glad he was there. But that's all he's done. And the reason he's reversed himself at every step along the way is because he wants to be, you know, he wants to run for office. He wants to have a future. And the only way to do that in that party is to climb right up back inside Donald Trump's rectum and be a big cheerleader for everything except that one moment.
And yet, ironically, he's the only one who can't seem to get back to qualify on the debate stage.
No.
Everyone else has gotten on there. Chris Christie apparently is going to qualify, but even Mike Pence can't get back on.
Heather, it seems like it's a problem that Republicans just don't care.
Yeah.
It seems like that ought to be a thing that the media would cover.
Well,
yeah, I think so.
They don't care. Heather, I didn't want to cut you off if you wanted to get in on that.
No, I did, because you and I have discussed this before, and I'm with Driftglass on this. I do not see Pence as being a big hero. I'm grateful for the fact that he didn't decide to overthrow the government that day. That was big of him, since every other vice president in history decided not to overthrow the government that day. And in this indictment, there is an interesting thing in it, which we didn't know before, at least I didn't, and I think it's new in the indictment. Well, it's not new. I mean, actually, the point that I'm going to make here is that they, you know, his, I guess it was his chief of staff, they were saying, Trump said to, and that would be Mark Short somewhere, said that said to him, well, you know, Mike needs to know that if he doesn't do what I want, I'm going to have to go public about him. Clearly a threat. And, of course, he did go public about him, you know, and we know what the result of that was. Mm-hmm. And Mark Short walked off and had a talk with the Secret Service that was protecting Pence. Now, we know what that was all about, right? We've seen that in the January 6th stuff where Pence was down in the garage and, they whisked him down there, and he refused to get in the car with the Secret Service, evidently afraid of getting it. I mean, he's later said, and it's a fatuous excuse, that, well, I didn't want anybody to see me leaving the Capitol. But there is something to that, in that they were afraid, obviously, that the Secret Service, which, you know, was many of whom were loyal to Trump, would whisk him off and keep him from coming back to certify the election later that day.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, here, this is the position they were in. Now, Pence knew that. He was warned ahead of time that Trump was going to go after him. Trump even said to him, well, you're too honest, when, you know, Pence said he couldn't do it. You know, Pence could have. Just picture where we were at that moment. The election was over. All the lawsuits were done. They were just on the cusp of going to certify the election. Mm-hmm. This is a day or two before the certification. You know, Pence could have called up Fox News and said, I need to come on today. I got something to say. And he could have blown the whistle on this before January 6th, before any of that stuff happened, and warned people, because he knew what was going to happen. And he didn't do that. So, to me, you know, I appreciate the fact that since the indictments come down, he said some stuff. I mean, today he was pretty salty. He said the president was surrounded by a group of crackpot lawyers that kept telling his itching ears what they wanted to hear, which is pretty good for Pence. You know, that's not that.
Yeah, you know, he didn't write that.
You know, so he's been, you know, since the indictment, and it's clear that he testified, right? I mean, he basically spilled his guts to the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he now, after all this, maybe he's just recognize that he has no constituency and he's never going to be president and might as well try to repair his damaged, you know, reputation. But, you know, there was a guy who knew what was happening and understood that Trump was getting very aggressive and threatening, and he didn't do that. You know, I mean,
I hear you, and I think when I talk about his moment of his profile and courage, it was that moment. It was that moment on the loading dock when he wouldn't get in to that car, because it would have been a very different story today had he done that, I suspect.
Yep.
So for that, we'll give him kudos for everything thereafter. Not so much. Very quickly, got just a couple of minutes here, and I want to get in some thoughts first. And I sort of want to get all three of your thoughts on this. I know I'm getting ahead of myself here. Well, maybe I'm not. How would you guys feel about Trump striking a plea deal to plead guilty, to pay a huge fine, to take some home confinement for a number of years in order to stay out of prison? And most importantly, a la Nixon and the vice president, Spiro Agnew, specifically, drop out of the race for president and vow to never run for public office again. If he floated that idea, how would you feel about that idea? Would you be in favor of it or against it, Driftglass?
You mean trust Donald Trump to keep his word that he's not going to run for office again, since there's no way to bind him legally to do that?
Okay.
No, I don't trust him at all. You know, this is, if we want to go all Nazi, it's Hitler signing and breaking treaties right and left. Donald Trump will say anything he wants, and 5 minutes later, when it conveniences him, he will turn around and say, I never said that. They tricked me into it. I had to do it. I was being clever.
Uh-huh.
They're a bunch of criminals, and I outsmarted them, and we're right back in the stuff.
So I want
them to go to prison. I want them to die there.
Okay. How do you really feel about it? Heather, your thoughts on that idea?
Well,
I mean, do you prefer to have him run for office, or do you want him out?
I would like to see him out, but I don't, you know, the idea of this is just so far-fetched, I can't imagine that it would happen. But I
really
do think the idea of home confinement is something that we should think about, because there's almost no way that Trump is going to be put in jail. And the reason is that he is required via the Constitution to have Secret Service protection. And there's almost no way to sort of do that. So I would expect that if he is found guilty and somehow or another we get through the appeals and he ends up having to actually do time, I think it will be home confinement. Him not allowed to go anywhere with a bunch of conditions. You know, no TV. He doesn't get to go on TV. He doesn't get to tweet. He doesn't do all these things as part of his sentence. in lieu of actually going to jail. I'm guessing that, but I just can't see it happening. How they would how they would actually put him behind bars, but they could confine him, which is fine with me. I just don't ever want to see him again. You know, just put him in there and get him away, and I don't want to hear from him, and I don't want to have anything to do with him. He's old. He's, you know, not going to be around that much longer anyway. So, you know, let it.
Well,
I
think at some point he's going to face a very real prospect of heading to prison. And I believe that if there is anything that Donald Trump is, it is a coward. And he does not want to go to prison, if only because he won't be able to coif his hair. And he's going, and I'm not kidding, and he will do anything to avoid that, including if, you know, his last Trump card, if you will, saying, okay, I'll drop out of the election. Send me to home confinement, by the way, in a, you know, my home resort that I live in, which
that
sounds like a pretty sweet
visit
deal.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think for me, I think the country really does need to go through this. And I would hope that the DOJ would not accept.
To go through the trial.
Yeah, to go through the trial, to go through airing it all out, no matter what happens. I mean, it's obviously going to take years to do this. You know, I don't know how many years, but many years, rather than trying to set it aside in a way that I don't think will work, especially based on what Driftglass just said.
So if he proposed that idea, if he floated it, you would oppose it, does he?
Yeah, I think so. Right. I think so. I think Driftglass makes a good point that you cannot trust Trump to abide by any agreement.
Lastly, let's run around the table here one more time, starting with Desi this time. How does this not hurt him politically? We hear this over and over again, not just from Fox News, but we hear it from the you know, the supposed non-right-wing media that, you know, every time he gets indicted, this helps him. His money comes in. His popularity goes up. It seems like that's among the Republicans, not among the American people. And I think that, you know, it does not help him, is my argument. I mean, I can't imagine that there is anyone out there who wants to vote for him now because of these indictments that was not otherwise planning to vote for the guy anyway. This does not help him. It can only hurt him, it seems to me. Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that the polls kind of show that there's a very distinct, very strong component of the electorate that is going to be ride or die with Trump no matter what. And beyond that ride or die group, I think that it is going to erode his support, because I think most Americans really don't want somebody who tried to overthrow the government as president.
Drifty?
I think that the right will be unaffected by this at all. There'll be no effect. They have a procedure for this, which is, you know, Hunter Biden's laptop, butter emails, scream like hell, jump up and down, wave your arms, and ignore it and say they're out to get us. So that's, you can write all of them off. Again, it's the people in the middle. It's the fence straddlers who really don't want to vote for either party. And is no labels looking good? I certainly like those no labels guys. That sounds interesting. I'm concerned that the people who are so terrified of taking a side don't want to take a side, that any alternative to throwing away their vote they will take. The last election came down to a few thousand votes in a few states.
Yes, it did.
And so it doesn't really matter what the popular vote is. What it matters is the Electoral College. And if we can just repeat the 2020 election, I'm fine with that. But I don't know that that's possible. I think Joe Biden is getting screwed by the media. I think he's doing a fine job. I think the economy has a story to tell. None of that is getting out. So it's going to be Trump until Election Day. And again, the people who want to believe that both sides are evil and both sides are bad and Hunter Biden's laptop is just as important as Donald Trump committing treason are going to go right on believing that no matter what anybody says.
Heather, your thoughts. Is it true? I hear what Bill is saying there, that it's going to make no difference on among Republicans. I just can't believe that is true. I mean, I know that there is 80% or something like that, that of the Republican Party that is all in for Donald Trump. But each and every one of these things, again, if you are a Republican who has always voted Republican, but you're just not sure how you feel about that Donald Trump guy, this is not going to help. This has got to hurt, at least hurt in the case of more people than it would actually help encourage them to vote for Donald Trump, right?
Well, I don't think it's going to get anybody to vote for him that wasn't going to vote for him. I don't think there's anybody. There's not a constituency out there for, gee, I really didn't like Donald Trump until he got indicted. You know, I mean, that's really, boy.
Right.
Now I'm really.
Good
point. I mean, maybe there are a few criminals out there. They go, hey, man, he's that's my dude. You know, I mean, I don't know, but I don't think that that's true. But I think it does. There are two things that are going to happen here, and that is that I think, as Driftglass says, you know, we're in hand-to-hand combat here. You know, this, or as you put it, trench warfare, which I think is a more apt,
political trench warfare.
And so, largely because of the fact that we have these two completely distinct media ecosystems and people are operating on completely different sets of information, that's a big problem. But there is a group out there. There are people that are sort of, you know, kind of, that aren't completely brainwashed. You know, there's some sort of independents who normally lean Republican. You know, they came out in 20, you know, let's face it, I mean, the Democrats really did well in the last three elections under the circumstances of trench warfare, political trench warfare. So, you know, that dynamic is going to be there. And I think that in that sense, the indictment actually hurts Trump. It will get his people out. They'll be out there to defend their, you know, their orange Jesus. But it also gets the other side out. You know, there are a whole lot of other people who just go, we can't have a criminal, you know, a guy who's just been convicted or he's on trial or whatever the situation is. We can't have that. We just can't have it.
Gosh, and I hope you're right.
You know, yeah, I hope.
I hope so. I hope you're right, too.
But we got to get out. We got to get out. I do hope you're right. We'll leave it with that positive thought. And a request to both of you to join us any minute now when Fonnie Willis comes in.
We'll hang here by the phone.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. Driftglass, otherwise known as Mr. Electrico on the Twitters or the website, formerly known as Twitter, can be found both there and at proleftpod.com. And Heather Digby Parton, otherwise known as Digby, can also be found at salon.com and digbysblog.net, as well as on the former Twitters at Digby56. Always great speaking with you guys. I look forward to it. We'll be doing it soon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we have got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you very much, Des. Mm-hmm. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, it's the special episode of the broadcast. You can download it or any other show we have ever done for free at bradblog.com. That, of course, is made possible by those of you who have been kind enough in the past to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help support our work here. Thanks to those in particular who have signed up for a monthly subscription of any amount you like or can afford. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the broadcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.